Hey everybody, welcome back to Cold Case Murder Mysteries. I'm your host Ryan Krause, coming at you once again to peek behind the curtain of one of Ireland's greatest unsolved mysteries, the disappearance of Trevor Dealey. On the evening of December 8th, 2000, the 22-year-old Dublin man, who worked in the IT department for Bank of Ireland Asset Management, attended a Christmas party with his co-workers that spanned multiple locations throughout the night and culminated close to 3:30 a.m. the next day. After leaving the location on foot and stopping back at the office to get an umbrella, Trevor appeared to be heading home for the night, but was in fact never seen again, vanished without a trace. So let's get an idea of who Trevor was, or is, and then document the events of the evening so we get an emotional understanding about what transpired to lead to this structural or material result. Basically, we want to identify a collision between an emotional value displayed by the victim and contrast to the equivalent material value desired by the perpetrator. That will tell us why Trevor disappeared, as evidence of motivation can be easily derived on a psychological level that way. We ask what the perpetrator wanted, and conversely, why Trevor didn't give it to him, leading to a situation in which force or death was the only option. Now, Trevor was apparently very close to his family, including his parents and three siblings, which is a strong indication he likes to have people in his company and often desires human connection. However, Trevor is also an IT professional, and it's the year 2000, prior to social media, so this is an era in which someone working long hours for a company relying on primitive IT would be separated from loved ones. People working in IT tend to be more introverted by default of their chosen field and interests, and it stands to reason that while Trevor truly needed the company of others, he might have struggled to find what he needed in terms of a balance between that introversion and his social life. As we said, Trevor was one of three siblings, so when he leaves home to get a flat with flatmates, he moves in with two other people, specifically young women. We get the impression these young women were friends and not romantic partners or even potential partners. And that tells us something. If Trevor lives with two young women who are friends, there's probably not a whole lot of room for him to have a girlfriend around. And that's the truth, as we know Trevor doesn't have a girlfriend or anything close to it. In reality, he sort of seems like a desperate young man at the time, which is pretty normal for a guy in his 20s. And here's why. This incident happened on December 8th, only 2 days after Trevor returned from a trip to Alaska on December 6th, which lasted several weeks. Now, it's cold and rainy in Dublin in December, so why the hell would anyone want to travel across the world to Alaska at that time and experience a much worse version of it with Alaska's heavy snow and low winter temperatures? I mean, you'd have to have a really good reason to be there. Well, according to Trevor's friends and family, he had recently met a young woman from Anchorage, Alaska, who was on vacation in Ireland and wanted to reciprocate by visiting her home. However, when she got back to Alaska and Trevor pushed to come visit her, the response was less than ideal. She tried to dissuade him from coming, and so he proceeded to set up the trip under the guise he was really just taking a holiday to Alaska. And the reason this is going to be disastrous is that he's thinking, there's a chance. If I can just get to her and she sees how far I've come, she'll let me in, not only into her home, but also her heart, because I've come all this way and gone to great lengths to prove I love her. The part of the equation that's missing in that grand denial, though, is that it doesn't matter what you do to prove you love somebody if the feeling isn't reciprocated. You cannot open a door that is locked from inside. That's the emotional issue at play here. Trevor doesn't have the key to this woman's heart, so to speak, and so he's left outside the locked gateway of her love with no way to get inside. And what that means is that if he isn't going to be allowed transcendence past that locked gate, some other man will instead. Undoubtedly, and inevitably. So Trevor travels across the world and finds himself denied on her doorstep. Her reception was supposedly as cold as the Alaskan winter landscape. And yes, Alaska is gorgeous, perhaps even unfairly so. And there's so much Trevor could have enjoyed there. And I'm sure he did, despite the rejection. But the truth would still be that he did all of those things alone in a barren, isolated wilderness that represented his emotional decay. She didn't want him, and as much as I'm sure he went back home bragging about all of the beautiful things he'd seen and experienced, not having the key to her heart and having come so far under adverse conditions to get it was devastating. So picture this. Trevor is the seeker. The young woman is the sought. When they intersect in Alaska, Trevor doesn't have the key to her heart. He's left outside the locked gate, knowing that another man is going to come along and take his place, meaning he's going to take the key. That's tough to accept on an emotional level, but on a more primal, instinctual level, it's akin to a fight between two predators in the wild for the rights to a female. In the case of Trevor leaving Alaska, there isn't going to be a showdown with another male for the hand of this young woman he desires. Civilized society doesn't work that way, normally. He can't just kill the other suitors to gain her acceptance. Yet, what will happen is that Trevor leaves this holiday empty-handed and with a broken heart. He simply did not have the key to this young woman's heart. And that rejection makes a man feel small and worthless, as though he's something less, specifically less adequate than what he should be. When rejected, we ask why. And some of those truths, if they are even truths, are not only very difficult to accept, but also irreconcilable against our persistent desires to overcome adversity. We have to walk a fine line between never giving up on love and what you believe in, as opposed to being stuck in a place because of that same refusal to quit. So here, the most likely result is that Trevor licks his wounds and goes back home to heal. Yet when he comes back, he's going to bring a profound level of loneliness with him. On the ride out there to Alaska, and during the projection in his mind which precipitated that trip, Trevor was going to reunite with this woman, and everything was going to be great. There was a chance, even if it seemed like she wasn't sure. We understand that he traveled very far to get to her, and that the distance across the globe that was involved and the financial resources spent are equivalent to the emotional value. That vacation was likely very expensive, especially for a 22-year-old. It sounds like he went all in, as though at a blackjack table in a casino, and he lost it all on this one gamble. That had to be painful, especially since he was told up front not to come. He allowed his desperation for love, along with his staunch denial, to captivate him. But the truth was a slap in the face. What a man wants from a woman, both physically and emotionally, is to be let inside, to be given access to the locked gate of her body, mind, and heart. To be kept out is to see that which you know has enormous value to you, or which you perceive has enormous value, but for which you can never get inside without force. Likewise, if you were a criminal trying to get into a building, the same goes, or an army in medieval times trying to get into a castle. It's all the same emotional value. So if you were Trevor Dealey, the one thing you would be most sensitive about, above and beyond any other emotional consideration at the time, is being locked out of something for which you believed you rightfully should have access. And as it would be true with a young woman, if another man tried to get inside, you'd fight him. When two male predators fight in the wild over a female, the basic elements or prizes for which they fight are these. The winner gets transcendence, and the loser gets irony, meaning the winner gets inside and the loser watches outside. Now, Trevor comes back from this trip, as I said, on December 6th, and both of his flatmates are out of town. So consider that. After enduring that humiliation on his trip, which ended up being really lonely, he comes home to an empty flat, specifically one which would normally be occupied with women who care. Symbolically, it's almost like they've just left him too, right? So they've left him alone, even if it's unintentional, a result of the fact that they're simply on holiday. But think about this very carefully. Imagine Trevor walking up to the door of his flat after coming home from that rejection, getting out the key, and opening the door to find out that he's not only alone, but the reason that he's alone is that the women who lived here left him. He's alone. That's a fact. And it matches his psychological state. His key, so to speak, is not unlocking the door to a life in which this young man finds love with a woman behind it. So basically, as Friday night rolls around and the holiday party is on the verge of coming to bear, Trevor knows he has nothing to go home to later that night but an empty flat devoid of female contact. Of course, that sounds like an opportunity to meet somebody while he's out and bring her home when his flatmates aren't around. Except we seem to realize that he struggles with such a thing. He isn't the guy who can easily go to the pub and pick up young women. And that means if he goes out drinking all night on Friday and meets no one, he's going to head back to that empty flat having failed again. It's daunting. It's lonely. Especially after what just happened in Alaska. And so, if you were him, you might avoid, or delay, facing that reality, right? I mean, for one reason or another, we have all avoided going home at certain times to try to escape an emotional fallout we knew was on the precipice of occurring. So, Trevor parties all night with coworkers, but once the party dies down after three locations and hours of drinking, it's time to go home. Some of those people, most of them in fact, would go home to loved ones. Trevor, however, faced the reality of going home alone. In the dark, in the rain, which matched his emotional state at the time after what just happened to him. I have been this guy, and I have made that walk home. It sucks. I've also been on the other side of the equation as the person with access through the locked gate of a woman's heart. And perhaps what strikes me here, above and beyond anything else, is that when I was left alone out in the cold to walk through that storm of isolation, what I desperately wanted emotionally was something to shield me from it. Those emotions, like cold rain, soak through your entire being and leave you shivering to the core, wishing you could go inside and find warmth. So when you feel like that, what you're going to ask yourself is, through what gate can I transcend to find that? And it has to be a gate for which he has the key. So, if Trevor leaves the last location, faced with the reality of loneliness and isolation ahead in the storm, we should see that idea of trying to shield himself manifest in his actions to follow. Accordingly, Trevor calls a coworker at Bank of Ireland Asset Management and says he's stopping by the building on his way home to borrow an umbrella because he doesn't have anything to shield himself from the rain along the journey. Now, there's a taxi strike in Dublin at the time, and he has to walk, which means he's already going to have to walk from the party back to the office, leaving him soaked when he gets there. The umbrella isn't going to be very helpful by that time. And obviously, it's Dublin, and the notion of not realizing it was going to rain is ridiculous. So, Trevor says he's coming back to get an umbrella. But what this is really about is the fact that he doesn't want to be alone, which is what will happen if he goes home. And we know he's lying about his intentions of just picking up an umbrella because the first thing he does when he arrives back at the office is make coffee and have a conversation with his friend or coworker that lasts more than a half hour. What he was saying symbolically in the subtext of wanting to go back and get an umbrella is that he needed something to shield him from this emotional storm ahead or the rain that won't stop falling on his life, and the umbrella is a talisman describing the necessity of human contact as a means of getting him out of the storm, aka loneliness. Notice that once Trevor goes and has a conversation with this guy, fulfilling that emotional need, then it manifests by him leaving with and utilizing an umbrella. He temporarily satisfied the emotional goal of protection from isolation, and the umbrella over his head manifested for the walk home in the sense that he just found connection with his coworker. But there's something we should notice here, and it's the apparent emotional value that the key to the gate at work affords Trevor. He walks up to the gate in the middle of the night, in the rain and cold, unannounced, and the key he possesses allows him to transcend that reality for warmth and comfort inside at will. It isn't just a key to the gate. It represents the only power of transcendence he possesses. He was able to go inside and find comfort with another person, even if it was less than what he desired. So for Trevor, this key to the gate at work represents not only the extent of his power, but also exemplifies how little he possesses in the way of the ability to transcend. We've all heard a phrase which describes an influential person as someone who can quote-unquote open doors. That's all this world is. Transcendence and irony, stop and go, yes and no. Transcendence equates to the people inside the gates, and irony equates to those outside desperately waiting to get in, the haves and have-nots. It comes down to a single truth. What we want is always inside. We just need the key to unlock the door to the truth. In this case, one man has the key and the other does not. The universe was designed that way. The alpha is allowed in. The beta is denied. And that's the issue here. Trevor has been having a traditionally beta type of experience, finding himself routinely stuck in second place while vying for the attention of women. It's so bad that on a Friday night at age 22, instead of going home with a young woman, he's heading back to work alone for coffee and conversation. This is days after traveling across the world to suffer the same. So at the time of his disappearance, that key to the gate outside work represented the tiniest piece of power that Trevor could boast, one that kept him from isolation. Now, in the wild, while there are often fights over females in which a winner is declared her next suitor, it's equally common to see the beta take off running because he simply can't compete with the alpha. He concedes being the beta and moves on to another potential opportunity with another female. But that's in relation to mating. Resources such as food are a whole different thing. If you don't eat, you starve, and so defending food comes with much greater urgency than courting a female for the purposes of mating. Even as the beta, you can't make a habit of surrendering all your resources that are necessary for survival. If you lose the opportunity to mate 4 times in a row, another will arise eventually. But if the alpha predator keeps taking what you need to live, meaning food, you're going to have to fight. Trevor's key to this building not only represents access to his resources in terms of what keeps him alive, aka feeds and shelters him, but it also constitutes the extent of the power he possesses. It offers food, shelter, human contact, and, even more importantly, identity. He has purpose there, and more importantly, they want and need him. If Trevor were to lose that key, sure, he could get another one, as he's an employee. But it isn't about a material key. It's about the emotional value of transcendence. This key can get him out of the rain, cold, and isolation of his emotional suffering. The worst thing that could happen on this night, in terms of an altercation between two male predators, is for one of them to try to take Trevor's key. It isn't about the key, as I said, it's about survival. Trevor is feeling vulnerable in terms of identity, and specifically as it relates to weakness, because his experience with women, most recently the catastrophic failure in Alaska, tells him he's a beta. If you feel like a beta in the wild, you're also inclined to be paranoid about other animals taking your resources, which is why animals often decline to show weakness if they can. And if that state of affairs continues, what will happen is that the beta reaches a place in which they feel they're being targeted and compensate with increased aggression as their backs are against the wall. We all know about the behavior of wounded or dying animals, extremely aggressive and unpredictable. So stronger predators corner them. In these moments, they no longer run as they can't. They stand their ground and die. It's because dominance in the wild boils down to this: being able to protect what's yours. If you can no longer protect what's yours, then someone else will come take it. For a male predator declining in the wild, sinking to beta status, the first element that would begin to escape you is the acquisition of female mates, followed by the inability to hunt for and protect your resources from lurking competitors. Those two elements go hand in hand in a symbiotic relationship because the binary backbone of what a male predator does in the wild is 1. Provide, and 2. Protect. That dictates a reality, or nature, in which hunting, by way of stealing, is common. The grand irony is derived from the need to do one in order to facilitate the other. Alternating binary ideas of protection and provision create a cycle called the hunt. That guarantees a collision or merger at the intersection of the seeker and the sought, or the hunter and prey, which, ironically, are one and the same. As I've said many times, this process of evolution, meaning binary collisions of opposing values, is guaranteed to balance to zero out of necessity because that's how our universe is constructed. Information, or energy, cannot be created or destroyed, which means that for every birth, there must be a death, and for every gain, a loss. The intersection of the seeker and the sought ensures structural adherence to that. If two things with opposing desires collide, the one with more power, or mass, or energy, by way of combining it with movement, wins. That's the place from which we derive the saying, the bigger they are, the harder they fall. But in order for the more massive structure to fall, the smaller one must then be faster and/or more accurate or skilled in some way, again, related to movement. In modern society, the gun remains the gold standard for both energy or mass and accuracy, while offering the practicality of being able to be concealed and carried by one person. A small person with a gun is very likely going to defeat a large person without one, as long as the larger person's skill, and therefore also the smaller person's lack of skill, doesn't prevent that result. Keep that in mind as we move forward here. Now, Trevor leaves the holiday party, which has fizzled out in the early morning hours, around 3:30 a.m., at which point he starts his walk back to work to get the umbrella. It's just a few minutes away. At the same time, security footage outside the Bank of Ireland Asset Management building shows a man in black standing in the rain in front of a small gate that leads to a walkway culminating in a door going into the building. It's one of two gates, the smaller one on that side of the building. So this man, again, who seems to be dressed in black, perhaps in a hoodie, including a black coat, has been standing right outside that small gate for approximately a half hour before Trevor arrives. When Trevor does in fact get there, the man is talking to somebody on a cell phone. The man notices Trevor pass, but doesn't take much interest until he sees that Trevor is heading for the larger gate nearby where they take deliveries. You can see his neck crane, as though he's waiting to confirm this person is going to enter the locked gate. And then he follows Trevor. But Trevor stops because he's finishing a phone call with the coworker that he's about to visit inside the building. So the man in black actually passes him and walks toward the larger gate, where he stands off to the side facing the building. Trevor soon joins him at the gate, but he goes to the lock at center to unlock it, which is where we see something really interesting. Actually, a couple of interesting things. The first is that the man in black turns to Trevor upon his arrival at the gate and speaks. Trevor responds. Of course, it's silent surveillance footage from the year 2000, so we're not privileged to the content of this short conversation. However, what we do know is that Trevor does not seem distressed in any way, and it doesn't appear to be any kind of argument. Furthermore, Trevor never mentions it to anybody inside the building. Not his coworker friend, or even security, so we have to assume that no hostilities were exchanged out there, and this man didn't come off as suspicious. I couldn't find any reason to believe that they knew each other. It doesn't seem to be the case. Trevor only gave this man a passing interest because he was addressed directly and then never seemed to think of it again. So I would conclude that they did not know each other. The second thing is that the chain on the gate wasn't locked because security had just come out to receive a delivery. The gate itself was locked, but the chain was off. I don't know why, though I would guess it had to be either negligence or that they were expecting another delivery or a similar visitor to come soon after that. Either way, it means that when Trevor arrives, security won't need to come out and let him inside. He can just unlock the gate without the chain on it using his key like he would during the workday and walk right in, which is what he does. And when he does, the man in black doesn't follow. Trevor simply walks in, closes and locks the gate, and goes inside the building without any interference, to the extent he never even mentions the man. So let's see what we can derive from the psychology of the events seen in the security footage leading up to Trevor's arrival at work. The first thing I would assert is that this isn't any sort of targeted hit on Trevor, or at least it doesn't begin that way. Anyone seeking to do him harm would have had ample opportunity to shoot, stab, or otherwise attack and kill him and get away in the dark. Anyone seeking to do him harm would have had ample opportunity to shoot, stab, or otherwise kill him and get away in the dark, rainy night, dressed in black. He walked right past the man in black, and the man didn't follow or even notice Trevor until Trevor went toward the larger gate. They even spoke, and Trevor seemed willing, meaning this person could also identify him as the target. None of that happened, so I don't believe Trevor was a target. Now, here's another thing. The man stood directly outside the smaller gate for a half hour prior to that, in the rain. Is it possible he got tipped off about the Christmas party and knew intoxicated people would be coming back this way for reasons similar to Trevor? Sure, they could have been at the same drinking establishment and a conversation was overheard about something valuable at the building. A person, meaning a worker, with knowledge might have been drunk and wanted to impress coworkers, not realizing who might be listening nearby. It's possible. But this is more likely. The man in black was in front of the small gate for a half hour in the rain before Trevor arrived. So, if you were part of the security team at BIAM, you'd be able to see him out there on the surveillance. I don't know how many people worked security in this place at night, but I guess it probably wasn't more than one or two, and likely just one. The man stands at the gate for so long that it should make security curious as to what he's doing there. Yet, on the other hand, he isn't doing anything wrong, and it's rainy and cold on a December night, so there's not much motivation to go out there, I'm sure. Security never goes out to make contact with him. That's extremely important here. Watch how it develops. We later learn that security came out to accept a delivery and left the gate without the chain locked, allowing Trevor to come in without calling them back out. But that delivery seems to have happened right before the man in black arrived, meaning he wouldn't be there when security came out to receive it. The reason, again, this becomes so important to our understanding of the situation is that if you're the man in black, you can get into the building by forcing Trevor's hand when he arrives, or that of any other employee. But what you can't possibly know is if security is watching inside the building at the time. The cameras outside are not hidden, and it's apparent this place has known surveillance as the man in black tries to never show his face. If he followed Trevor inside, even if it was by way of a lie that Trevor believed to be true, causing him to concede, the man in black still would not know what to expect when he arrived inside the building. Security has a very clear technological advantage over him by being able to watch what he's doing. And that is where most analysis of this case fails. They do not look for the technological deficiency and end up telling you that this kid falls in a fucking canal. No. Now, again, in relation to security, conversely, for all the man in black knows, those security guards could be asleep, or they could be waiting with guns drawn. In that situation, the uncertainty caused by the technological advantage gives security the upper hand. That's what this is about. They could be lying in wait when the man enters. So I think what likely happened here is that the man in black arrived believing the delivery was pending and that he could accost security when the guard came out. Again, it was probably just one person on the night shift, and the intention of the man in black was to draw that guard from the uncertainty of having the upper hand inside the building to abandoning it unknowingly by way of coming out. He's trying to extract the technological advantage of the security guard. And guess what? It's not working, because in order to do that, you need better technology. And he's not using better technology. He's acting like a fucking fool, which is why no crime ever takes place here other than somebody trying to get the key from Trevor. Now, think of it this way, right? If he's standing outside and he can draw the guard outside by way of the delivery, right? He doesn't actually have to manipulate anything. This happens organically. But the problem here, again, is that the delivery has already taken place. But if it had not, think of it like this. Once he sees the guard outside, away from the technology that gives him the upper hand, he knows exactly what the guard is doing. That technological advantage is gone, and that is when you smash people. Obviously, the greatest concern is that the guard would quickly follow protocol and take action, or even contact the Garda, causing a much bigger problem. You can't have that. You have to extract his technological advantage. And his technological advantage is being able to stay inside the building without being seen. If he comes out, not only can he be seen, but without the upper hand of the technology, he is unable to see. So what's going on here is that this man is trying to draw the guard out in order to get a technological advantage. And of course, you can't stand out there acting like a fool, because then the guard would just call the Garda, right? It's like, hey, call the police. There's a problem outside. This guy is a security guard for the building. So if you are these people, you need to get inside by way of drawing security out. But you can't draw them out with something outrageous like pulling a gun or attacking somebody or making a threat or waving your arms around, because they could simply just call the Garda or police. So controlling the guard and getting the upper hand on the way into the building, instead of grabbing somebody like Trevor as a hostage, is a professional move. It's much less risky. This strikes me as a robbery connected to organized crime. After the man in black waits a half hour at the smaller gate in the rain, he's on the phone with someone, which is probably a call that consists of subject matter like, what should I do? He isn't moving. He's here at the building, standing in the rain like a fool. Trevor is not his target. This building is his target, specifically something inside it which has value. If the target was someone other than Trevor, the man in black would have walked away, even if he needed to address Trevor to know he wasn't the target. But look what he does. His body language tells us so much when he meets Trevor at the gate. He walks out ahead of Trevor and stands off to the side to allow Trevor access to the lock area. He remains there, facing the building. So what he's saying is that he sees Trevor as a way to get inside, but as Trevor arrives at the gate, they speak, and then Trevor goes to unlock the gate. The man turns toward Trevor, though he doesn't attack. This would have been the perfect time. He could easily get through the gate. What's happening here is that the transcendence through this locked gate he projected as a result of Trevor's arrival is now literally turning into irony instead, meaning that because the chain on the gate is unlocked, now he can't get inside. If that gate is not chained, then Trevor can just walk in and security never needs to come out. And so security does not come out. And so the man does not go in, even though he could have just walked right in with Trevor. And so when this man in black realizes the truth while facing Trevor and seeing that chain, he then turns away from the gate and stands with his back to it, symbolizing irony or denial of transcendence. And of course, that's when Trevor goes through and he doesn't follow. He concedes with body language even before Trevor even walks through. And if you ask yourself, well, why would this guy not go through the gate if that's what he wanted? The whole point is that he can't because security sees him out there, as far as he's concerned. He has to draw security out. But if Trevor is going through the gate and has done nothing to stop this man, it's apparent the man could follow by way of force, such as his fist, knife, or gun. But again, he doesn't follow. He actually stands outside like a lost puppy, looking like he can't get in. It's crazy. It's fully apparent that if this man intended to hurt Trevor, or even use him simply as a means of getting inside, he had a fully unobstructed path to doing so. Nothing was stopping him. But he didn't do it. He didn't go in. And what we understand from that is that he needed to get into the building, but under circumstances which couldn't happen in the context of him having proof that security isn't lying in wait and hasn't called the guard already. This guy has to be paranoid if he's about to pull off a crime. For all he knows, security could see him, identify him as a threat, and call the guard before he even goes into the building. So it's not difficult to see the man in black's desperation escalate from here. Once Trevor goes inside, he remains at the gate, facing the building, waiting in the rain, even more conspicuously now than he was when he was at the smaller gate. I believe he's trying to draw security outside to ask him what he's doing. But as he waits there, two other men dressed in dark clothing appear at the gate. And you know what they say. Three's a crowd, so the man in black bails for parts unknown. In the aftermath, we learn these two men, who showed up after the man in black, actually worked at the building, and it seems like they were just waiting to get inside. It's possible that they were waiting for security to come out and let them in, but with two bystanders now, if you're the man in black, you suddenly need to employ crowd control. Somebody might try to fight or call for help. You could have multiple people with phones and multiple people who could run. So, again, you have a crowd control situation. With only Trevor there, it's somewhat more manageable. Now, I see this event as an intended stick-up in which the assailant shows up outside, draws the guard out, pulls a gun, and forces the guard to comply with taking him into the building under the guise he's there to pick something up, in the same way they have things delivered and have people coming and going otherwise. That's ideal. It's quiet. But without question, what he must do is get the technological upper hand in some way in terms of getting into the building, knowing that he isn't walking into a trap before he starts. As it stands, however, security has a technological advantage with surveillance, which means their pursuit of universal truth here is at a much later stage of evolution than his, and so he is the one in ignorance and has to reverse that role somehow. That's the point. The guard is sitting in there with an eye on him, meaning the camera, and he has no eye on the guard, so he has to reverse that position. And that's a very difficult thing to do. You know, if you're going to do something like that, the idea is to employ technology that is greater than what is being used to spy on you, right? You have to have more truth than the other person. That is how evolution works, the collision of that technological desire. But anyway, what's apparent is that in the darkness of a cold, rainy night, with everybody dressed according to the inclement weather, the security footage from back then, including almost anywhere, wouldn't be good enough to identify individuals. So if men dressed in dark clothing were coming in and out and looking relatively the same, the only way security could reliably distinguish you from an intruder on that video is whether or not you were able to access the gate using your key. So the delivery already came, drawing out the guard, and the man in black wasn't there yet to indulge the opportunity. That's strike one. Then he stands at the smaller gate for a while, looking shady, but fails to draw the guard outside. That's strike two on his plan. Notice these are all technological failures. Then Trevor shows up a while later, and because the chain is off the gate due to security failing to put it back on after the delivery, there isn't any need for security to come outside, and they don't. That's strike three. And you only get three strikes, but in the case of sociopathic behavior, even in organized crime, there often isn't any type of plan B to accompany the potential failure of plan A. So our guy is just going to keep on swinging here. It's at this point he just stands outside the larger gate, staring ahead, facing the building, desperately hoping to draw security outside by being suspicious. But again, this didn't work at the other gate, and it isn't going to work here either, because if you don't behave like an asshole in a manner that would get the police called on you, security isn't going to react. This is the overnight shift. It's cold and raining outside. If you're just standing out there looking suspicious, who cares? And that's really the reaction it gets. So when the other two guys show up and things get crowded, he decides to change things up a bit. It appears on the footage that the man in black leaves, but we only know that he walks out of range of the cameras. They don't show much more than the sidewalk outside and part of the street in the shadows beyond that. So it becomes abundantly apparent this guy can't keep going to a dry well for water. If he wants to surprise the security guard and demand compliance through the leverage gained by that act, he'll have to find a different way to do it. And he's not going to, because there's a technological requirement that he is not satisfying. This person is a buffoon, a total fool. I mean, this is what looks like low-level organized crime by somebody with an average mind. Unfortunately for Trevor Dealey, he literally showed the man, meaning the man in black, that he has a working key to the gate. So at this point, it's like staring him in the face kind of obvious that the best course of action is to get the key from Trevor or anyone who comes out of the building. Yet, he can already guarantee, and he knows, that Trevor has a working key. But as the chain isn't locked, anybody's key would be fine. Of course, you couldn't accost any of these workers outside the building, because, again, security would see it and call the guard. So you'd have to follow them. Not coincidentally, guess how Trevor ends up disappearing, right? This isn't hard. And that's when Trevor becomes a target. all the man in black has to do is wait for someone to come outside. And Trevor fits the bill for both coming out fairly quickly, meaning within 30 minutes or so, and also walking away from the building on foot. He doesn't get into a car. Again, this key that he's holding has been seen by the man in black and verified to be the one that could get him through the gate. If this man was stuck out there, at a loss as to what he should do because the plan that he drew up to draw security outside failed, seeing Trevor exit the gate on foot and knowing there was a key in the unsuspecting employee's pocket would be an irresistible temptation. He's desperate. Unfortunately for this man, he's likely thinking only of the key and not the underlying symbolic value it has for Trevor that we already talked about. This could become an explosive situation because that thing is something emotionally that Trevor needs to defend. If he takes that key, that's the last of his transcendence. He's already watching other men take these women around him. So this man is going to follow Trevor. Now what happens is that Trevor has coffee with his friend inside, then he grabs an umbrella, and the last we see of him outside this building is when he exits through the larger gate and walks off on foot. This is just after 4 a.m., and what facilitates such a great mystery is that, from here, we actually have one more sighting of Trevor, a confirmed one, by way of surveillance from a camera outside a bank, specifically an ATM, that resided along his path home. When he walks past, giving us a view of him from the back, the time is 4:14 a.m. As he fades in the distance, out of range of the camera, Trevor is never seen alive again, other than by those with knowledge of the crime, mainly the perpetrator, or perpetrators, if in fact he was accosted by more than one person that night. Now, we get a pretty good indication that he was indeed followed by the man in black because 30 seconds after Trevor walks past that camera, a man in black resembling the one we saw outside Trevor's workplace follows. If we take a logical approach to this situation, the most likely scenario is that the man in black and whomever he's working with, meaning whomever he was on the phone with, if anybody, even a driver following nearby, are looking to follow Trevor Dealey to a place they deem low risk in terms of being seen and or heard attempting to rob him of the key. What we notice is that the initial stretch Trevor walks is all on the same road where he works, which suggests that there would be pedestrians, surveillance, and cars on this route, even at this hour of the night, all of which is truly supported by security footage. So, the importance of approaching Trevor in a stick-up situation involving a more inconspicuous place along his route home is that you have another crime to commit after this one, at the bank building, and being detected in a way that prevents it would mean you've compromised the end goal. The end goal isn't to get the key from Trevor, but to get inside Bank of Ireland Asset Management for whatever purposes they desired. That means you need to accomplish two things. Getting the key quietly is number one, of course, and the other is to detain Trevor in the aftermath as you commit the crime, as he's obviously just going to call people if he gets robbed for the key and the assailant takes off. What I think happened here is that they waited for a spot and time during the walk in which they believed they could approach him off camera and without witnesses, and then the man in black performed the equivalent of a stick-up for the key and a kidnapping by way of putting him in a car driven by whomever he had been working with, as evidenced by phone calls. The huge problem with this, of course, and the reason it didn't start as their plan, and only became their plan once they botched plan A, is that it involves taking a hostage. And if he knows what you want in the form of the key, then he's also going to know who committed the resulting crime at his workplace in the aftermath. All of which is to say this equation, when calculated, dictates you kill a witness like this. Trevor had the key to the building, but if they took it, he would have also had knowledge of the crime to come and who committed it. They couldn't risk that. And of course, we don't know if there was an altercation when these two met on the street, when they intersected. Was Trevor acting like that beta, like the dying animal? Was he going to defend this key? We don't know. He very well might have, and that might have led to his demise. Or he might have complied, and he died anyway. And how these issues compound in reality, and again, why they didn't plan it this way in the first place, is that once they have a dead body, or even just a hostage who's destined to become mulch, the problem of how to conceal that murder becomes the imperative, above and beyond the crime you planned at Trevor's workplace, because even just from a standpoint of criminal liability, murder offers the worst penalties. If they killed him, immediately concealing the evidence would become far more important than carrying out the robbery that was initially intended, as that robbery, even if they got caught, would not offer even nearly the criminal sentence that murder would. When and if they killed him, they had more to lose by it than to gain by the original plan. I can see the desperation of the man following Trevor down the street, and realize that his only thought was likely about how to acquire that key. He, or they, didn't give much consideration to the potential fallout because they were desperate for an alternative when their plan hit a snag. Someone with the ability to plan this ahead of time would ask, what if he refuses? What if he fights back? And even if he does or doesn't, what do we do with him in the aftermath? Because he's going to know. Those things would have been considered beforehand if the crime was planned this way with Trevor being assaulted. But apparently, nothing was planned that way, and he ends up dead. Now, Trevor, though his flat was still a significant distance from the last place he was seen by the ATM camera at the bank, is not seen on any security footage elsewhere past that point. Given that a man in black who strongly resembles the one at the bank building is following him at this point, and then Trevor disappears forever, it's fair to say a dispute likely occurred involving possession of the key. It might have even been disguised as something else, such as a robbery for his wallet and/or his coat. But one way or another, this man's intentions were going to collide with Trevor's reaction at the intersection of the seeker and the sought. That's what it is. The intersection of action and reaction. We don't have reports of an unknown altercation occurring on the street that night, nor was there any report of gunfire that could be attributed to this incident. In that light, what I see as most realistic is a circumstance in which the man walking on the street was working with a driver who followed nearby. Even if Trevor was murdered in silence, such as by way of a knife attack from behind or pistol whipping, which is consistent with how he was being followed on camera, there was never any indication thereafter that a violent crime had occurred. In fact, in preparation for a visit from Bill Clinton in the coming days, buildings and receptacles in the surrounding area were searched to accommodate extensive security measures, which means the area was scoured for evidence in a way it would not have been otherwise. That lack of evidence leads me to believe Trevor Dealey got in a car, whether through force, manipulation by threat of a weapon, or both. I think he was taken somewhere as a means of keeping the incident quiet, and then when it finally dawned on the perpetrators that they needed to cut their losses, they executed him and abandoned whatever plan they had to commit a crime at the Bank of Ireland Asset Management Building. Clearly, if they got rid of Trevor, the only opportunity to use that key moving forward would be that same night. But once they ended up with a body and a second-rate plan, they refused to incur more risk. Again, this crime strikes me as being a result of a botched plan that unraveled as they tried to adapt and manifest a positive result, absent of the technological requirements, something that only dug them a deeper hole that they wouldn't be able to get out of had they gone any further. So they just bagged it. I think they saw Trevor as a solution, as Plan B, in their desperation, but once they had him, he became a liability too great to bear if they let him go, which, ironically, was already true before they nabbed him, but they were so desperate and did not plan that ahead of time. By killing him and neglecting to return to his workplace to commit the intended original crime, they walk away without losing anything or risking anything more. And that's especially important here because any connection to a subsequent crime at the BIAM building after Trevor's disappearance is going to have one suspected of his murder. At that point, you aren't risking getting caught for a robbery. It's murder. And so, that's why silence ensues. This thing had to be quiet. They had to put a lid on it at that point. They cut their losses. I think the man in black was one of two or more guys who were soldiers in an organized crime crew, sent out in a car by their boss or superior to carry out some type of financially related crime at the BIAM building that night, whether a robbery, destruction of data or paperwork, or similar. I believe their intention was to draw the guard or guards outside without making a fuss that would incline them to call the authorities as well, at which point leverage over security would allow free passage into the building, absent of suspicion by anyone else. They, or even just the man in black, intended to go in and out without a sound, as perpetrating any sort of traditional bank holdup, so to speak, could have people calling for help and fleeing. My understanding is that this takes place in the middle of the night, after which most employees have been drinking for hours at a holiday party and have gone home because it suggests the least interference possible. This was supposed to be very quick and quiet, and when it got out of control and on the precipice of being too difficult to contain, somebody decided silence was better. They don't go back to the building with Trevor's key, and he doesn't go home. Not ever again. Yet more than 20 years later, his disappearance is still a mystery. Did Trevor fight back to protect the symbolic meaning of that key, refusing to hand it over because of pride that wouldn't allow him to concede anything more than the fresh humiliation he suffered by way of rejection from the Alaskan woman? Did he find the animal within and unleash his rage, however faulty the notion? Or did he concede the key, deciding it was better to let go, and paid the ultimate price anyway? We don't know. There are even some who believe that he might have fallen in a canal or a river that night and drowned while drunk, and even others who think a separate incident might have occurred over the weekend, as he wasn't reported missing until Monday and his phone seemed to be working. However, his sister's assertion his phone was ringing, according to experts, does not necessarily mean it was powered on, operational, and actually ringing when she called. To this day, Trevor's belongings, from his clothes to that key, are also missing. The last trace of him constitutes those images of a lonely man walking through a dark, cold, rainy night into an oblivion we do not know, an abyss that lies beyond. And in his hand was that umbrella, which, despite its utility, cannot shield us from the storm to come, from a past that slowly creeps up behind, until finally we're gone.